So, retrospectors, what historical events are we ticking off on this week's run of Today in History?
Well, Tuesday is the anniversary of the first Tarzan movie to hit the silver screen.
Then on Wednesday, we tell the story of how Gottlieb Daimler inadvertently invented the motorbike.
On Thursday, we explain how MSG got demonized in the 1960s.
And on Friday, we revisit a legendary battle on a frozen Russian lake.
We discuss this and more on Today in History with the retrospectors. 10 minutes each weekday, wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hello and welcome to the Media Podcast. I'm Ollie Mann. On today's show, it's a BBC sizzler. We discuss all the big announcements to come out of the first annual plan. More money for kids, fact-checking, podcasting. What does it all mean? We'll find out. Plus, is Jon Snow the real purveyor of hate, and was The Guardian drunk at Glastonbury? I may have got that the wrong way round. And in the media quiz, we find out who knows their media onions. It's all to come on today's Media Podcast. And joining me on the roof terrace, it's summer, forgive the sirens, at Picture House Central, our Business Insider's senior news editor, Jake Cantor, and Something Else's managing director, Steve Ackerman. Steve, for those who aren't regular listeners, to give us a flavour of the kind of work Something Else makes, I note recently that you had DJ Semtex offering gardening advice.
Well, it wasn't actually DJ Semtex, it was DJ Khalid, who's very famous apparently, talking to Semtex, and he's big into his gardening. And so, yes, that video, which has done very, very well for One Extra, was then retweeted on the Gardener's Christian Time Twitter feed.
Wow, that's an impressive spread of, and so you do both things, do you? One Extra and Gardener's Christian Time.
We do, yeah.
There you go. That's the breadth right there. Jake, what's been your hottest story at Business Insider UK this week?
We had a really great story last week, I can tell you about, which got our name mentioned.
Good enough, we're only on every three.
Got our name mentioned in Parliament.
Okay.
Which was quite exciting for the whole office. Our politics reporter, Adam Payne, wrote about the fact that a group of Tory MPs were lobbying for Andrea Leadsom to become the new leader of the Conservative Party. And she was called out on it in Parliament, and our name was dropped, and it was all very gratifying.
That is, yeah. And if you're going to take a reputable source that politicians are reading and quoting in the House of Commons that has an exclusive on an inside political story, I think generally speaking, you know, until perhaps just a year ago, that would be expected to come from, well, basically the Telegraph or the Guardian.
Yeah, I think so. I think it's an indication of our ambitions, certainly. We've brought in a new politics editor, a guy called Adam Biankoff, who's doing great stuff for us. And yeah, we're seeing the traffic as well.
Well, as we used to say at The Guardian, let's start with the BBC, because I've consolidated not one, not two, but three BBC stories into one exciting whole. They have announced a string of developments designed to make them competitive in this ever-changing digital landscape, it says here. So let's tackle these incentives one by one. First, more money for children's programming. £34 million budget increase over the next 3 years. Steve?
Long overdue, very sensible. Completely the right space the BBC should be placing itself in when you bear in mind the lack of spend in other areas on children's.
But why has that happened, by the way? The BBC makes 97% of UK children's programming and can't carry ads. I mean, you'd kind of think, surely, you know, where do Disney and Hasbro and Mattel want to advertise? Why aren't ITV and Channel 4 and Channel 5 making more kids stuff?
Well, probably the answer is because for people like Disney, they've got their own outlets, and it's clearly difficult to compete on that in that space. I think the other advantage the BBC have in terms of kids is obviously it is a safe space. It's an advert-free space, and I think you often find parents will encourage their children to go to the iPlayer, or to go online to go and absorb BBC content because of that. So, you know, I think this is a... You have to shout when the BBC get it right, because quite often they get bashed. And I think on this one, they're absolutely right.
Well, their kids' programming is excellent. There's no question about that. But you say getting it right. They're only doing it because Ofcom told them to, aren't they, Jake?
No, I don't think that's fair on the BBC. I think they've got,
true,
they've got a genuine...
Ofcom told them to, and now they're doing
it. That's
the order of events.
To children's. I mean, look, there was big lobbying last year from PACT, Animation UK, the Children's Media Foundation. They all wanted the BBC's children's budget to stay over 100 million over the course of this charter. It looks like they've succeeded in that aim. You know, the BBC, as Steve said, should be applauded when it gets things right. And I don't think this is just a political sop. I think the BBC does have a genuine commitment to children's. It always has done. It's always done it brilliantly. And I'm sure we'll see lots more great content, not just on television, but online as well, more importantly, where a lot of this resource is going to go. And Steve's also right. This is a big industry-wide issue. There is not enough commitment to children's from other broadcasters. And Ofcom, if it's kicking the BBC to get into children's, it should be doing exactly the same to Channel 4 and more often, because...
Yeah, there's zero hours on Channel 4
yeah,
now.
Under Jay Hunt, children's was completely neglected.
No, but it's literally zero. I looked at the figures. I mean, Channel 5 still does 30 hours or something. Channel 4 does zero.
Channel 4 would argue that they are trying to cater for a slightly older audience. They sort of count children as sort of 8 to 13, 14. I'm not sure if that bracket's quite right, but an older children's audience. And that's where they're focusing resource. But I don't think it's having the impact that they believe it is.
And that digital area for kids, what sort of innovation do you think there might be there and opportunities for producers like you, Steve?
Well, funnily enough, you know, definitely overlapping with one of the other BBC stories, I think you've got to look at podcasts or on-demand audio. It's certainly something that I think you've seen some people like Matt Deegan, I'm trying to remember the name of his...
Folder Media.
Folder Media, that's right. Fun Kids, who do a fantastic job. But it's something they've I think, been very proactive in. So I think you've got to look in that space. It's difficult in the game space because that's obviously very well developed, and you know the BBC just doesn't have the sorts of funds you really need, I think, to do that well. But where sort of interactivity, you know, online and interactivity meets, so sort of simple web games that can be played online, the BBC's done that very well for kids, and I think doing more in that space, again, where it's got an educational purpose or a public service purpose, I think is a really interesting space for them to be looking at.
And of course, it's not really new, is it, in the sense that, you know, the first computer I ever used was a BBC Micro. They've been doing that for years.
Well, and also, I mean, they have actually been spending fairly significant amounts in the online space with interactivity. I think a lot of it goes under the radar, but, you know, over the past 6, 7, 8 years, they have continually spent in these areas.
Okay. A great project they did last year was the microchip, BBC microchip, which has been sent to all 11-year-olds in schools, and it is encouraging them to code. Only the BBC could provide that kind of public service.
It would be quite scary if Richard Desmond did. Let's move on to the second BBC story. I was going to make it the third one, but you teased it there, Stephen. I'm agile. That's what we are here at the Media Podcast. And that is the BBC's plans to produce original podcasts. James Pennell announced that. He says that the UK lags behind the US and Sweden in terms of podcast listening, and that's because the BBC hasn't been able to innovate in the medium because of regulations. Is that true? Because I look at the iTunes chart and there's a lot of Kirsty Young and there's a lot of Friday Night Comedy, and okay, they're not innovating, they're rebroadcasting radio shows, but I can see why that regulation existed. That's to stop them completely dominating all podcasts.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's... I mean, you know, the key point about this is that there's been a relaxation in the rules so that they can create original content just for online, whereas up until now, they were only allowed to put into podcast formats programmes that were already broadcast.
So the best example of that is the Chris Warburton one for 5Live, which is a true crime podcast and only exists as a podcast at the moment. It's been a number one show.
That's right.
Is that the kind of thing the BBC should be doing?
I mean, I'm not sure I agree with James Pennell that the reason podcast numbers are lower in this country is because the BBC hasn't been able to do that. And I think you're absolutely right that we've got a very dominant audio broadcaster. And actually, there has been a lot of innovation in the podcast space. And you know that better than me because you're one of the people who's led the way on that front, not only with this podcast, but with some of your other very well-known ones.
I'm not interrupting you.
Well, you know, I wasn't sure how far the plugging should go.
You can carry on.
And, you know, I'm not sure from what I've heard so far whether I'd say that's innovation. I mean, certainly things like the Chris Warburton podcast, it's really picking up on what we've already seen coming out of America in terms of the innovations there. I'd really like to see the BBC be a lot more adventurous in what they're trying to achieve in the podcast space.
And what about the sports stuff? You both listen to more sport than I do. There's a Freddie Flintoff one, isn't there?
Yes,
what's that like?
Uh, Freddie Robbie and the Ping Pong Guy or something?
Yeah, I'm not sure if that comes under James, though, because that would be being produced in Salford, which probably comes out of Five Live and therefore is a sport.
It does come out of Five
podcast.
Live, yeah.
But it only
yeah.
exists because they're allowed to make original podcasts now.
Yes, yes. I mean, look, James Pennell's got a big new job as head of radio at the BBC, and his grand innovative idea is boom 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 podcasts. I mean, come on,
how dated.
No, I mean, have you heard of Serial? It's really good. No, I'm kind of a bit ambivalent about this. I think look, the BBC at its best is the tide that lifts all the boats, and you would hope that it has that effect in the podcast space by committing a bit more resource to it, but at its worst, it will drown everyone.
What about?
I'd be interested to hear your thoughts.
Well,
to be honest.
Well, thank you for asking me, Jay. I'd be interested to see whether the UI for Radio iPlayer or whatever they're using for promoting this stuff on a BBC branded site is actually going to become open to independents now, because we had that discussion, didn't we, around BBC iPlayer for TV content, and it never happened for understandable rights reasons. It's complicated to put a Channel 4 show on iPlayer. I'm saying it never happened. I think there are a few instances, aren't there, of public service broadcasting where they've done that. But with podcasting, there really isn't an issue, apart from making sure that the show's passed general taste and decency standards. Why? If you listen to, for example, to take something that springs to mind, The Media Show on Radio 4, that it wouldn't then recommend that you listen to this. That would be a genuine boost to all podcasters if the BBC were able to offer that, but I'm not seeing any plans along those lines.
Yes, the sort of podcast equivalent of what they did with the radio player.
Yeah.
I mean, I think the other question is clearly one around the commercial market. You know, I know you were discussing this on the last edition, in terms of Apple, obviously, are starting to open up some of the numbers there. And, you know, just at a time when the podcast market commercially is just starting to bring in revenues, and certainly in America, very significant revenues. I mean, I saw a fantastic talk from Ira Glass where he went on to some of the stats that This American Life and Serial are doing and the revenues they're bringing in. It really is, it's phenomenal numbers. But just as a time when that's starting to happen in the UK, what you don't want is obviously a broadcaster who's not doing anything for commercial gain coming in and really swamping the market to the extent that it's very difficult for that market commercially to get off the ground.
They're only doing eight projects.
For now.
For now. It's yeah. early doors.
Okay. And actually, one final question on this before we move on to the third exciting BBC announcement. Steve, for you, because something else produced the Mayo and Kermode show, don't you? Which has, what, 250,000 downloads an episode, something like that?
A million a month, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. Fine. You can figure that how you like. I guess there's a back catalogue. Am I right in saying you are allowed to monetize that commercially overseas but not in the UK?
That's correct, yeah.
Do you think... And of course, in a way, you'd be shooting yourself in the foot to say yes. But do you think that's the right judgment, that listeners in the UK, you've paid for it through the license fee, you shouldn't have to listen to ads? Or is it more like in the old days when you used to buy a DVD of Fawlty Towers and there'd be an upfront cost for that? It's not designed to be included in the license fee.
No, I do think it's right that in the UK, I mean, that content has been paid for by all of us, by the license fee payer. And therefore, I think if you're in the UK, I think it is right you should be able to have that free of charge. So I haven't got a, as the person making it and the person who could make money out of that, I haven't got a problem with that.
But it is right to then charge overseas listeners to enjoy our content for free that we pay for.
Yes, absolutely, because what that does is return money back. Obviously, as the producer, we would see some money, and Kermode and Mayo would see some money, but it would return money back to the BBC as well. So that's obviously in the licence fee payer's interest.
Okay, are you ready for that third exciting BBC story?
Hit me.
I'm sensing the excitement in the air. It's this: Reality Check, their fact-checking service, is going to expand. We're living in a post-truth universe, as we've discussed on the show many times, but again, there are independent organisations doing this, like Full Fact, who we interviewed on the show. Do we need the BBC to be doing this? Jake?
Yes. I think the BBC has a role to play in fact-checking, and you've got to remember that the BBC is the most trusted media organisation in this country, and I think viewers and listeners will always rely on the BBC to tell them the truth and exactly how a story is shaping up. And if people like that in the form of a fact check or whatever you want to call it, then more for them.
It seems to me, though, that people are quite prepared to ignore the fact that the BBC does this and then say it doesn't exist anyway. I mean, during the Brexit campaign, there's all this business about, oh, the stuff that was written on the side of the bus, that was a lie. Why did no one tell us that was a lie? I remember sitting through some quite tedious BBC packages telling me exactly how that money broke down, that it wasn't entirely truthful, that it related to a particular portion of the pie. Do people really read this fact-check stuff anyway? They still seem to get out of it what they want.
Well, this isn't. Well, first of all, this isn't really about back of the bus stuff, is it? I mean, this is, I think, completely about the evolution of news in the online space, and the way that clearly inaccurate or false stories can gain huge traction, you know, through just being picked up and shared. And so I think the BBC as a trusted source has got that role to play. And you say, well, you know, these things were being picked up. I think still the fact that there's a place you can go to just find out for yourself, even if that's only a small minority of people who might be inclined to do that, is quite important. And especially for the journalistic community. You know, as resources get hit more and more for news journalism, I think this is a great function for how a public service broadcaster should be behaving.
But then one of the resources that has been cut since 2010 is BBC monitoring. That could have been a place to be doing reality check stuff.
Are you saying the BBC's got double standards on things?
I wouldn't. I'm balanced and impartial, of course, under my own regulatory
system.
Well,
we saw Tony Hall talking this week about securing the future of the BBC and making sure it appeals to young viewers, but they took £50 million out of BBC Three a couple of years ago. So, you know, I think there's always going to be mixed messages from the BBC. It's such a big organisation that contradiction does creep in.
Right. Well, I don't know about you listeners, but I enjoyed those three BBC stories so much, I'm going to chuck in a fourth. Are you ready?
I wasn't expecting this.
No. Who was? Personalised content for iPlayer. What do we think about that?
It's a good thing. I think the most interesting thing that's happened in the last few weeks is that you now have to sign in to iPlayer to access content. And I think the most recent figure I could find was from last year. And I think the BBC's got about 7.2 million registered users. And that will increase sharply now that people have to log in. And there were figures last year as well that of those 7.2 million people, they are watching 40% more content because of what is being recommended to them.
Wow. And Steve, when Ben Cooper came in at Radio 1, he said the average age of our listeners is too old. Therefore, we have to lose listeners in order to sort of go back to focusing on what we're supposed to be actually achieving. What about if iPlayer concludes that the average age of a BBC viewer or a BBC online viewer is older or younger or more male or more female or more city-based or more rural-based than they want? Should they then be acting change on the basis of that data?
I'm not sure it's quite the same, is it? Because iPlayer is an all-encompassing tool for all the different BBC brands, whereas obviously for Radio 1, there's a particular demographic they were being asked to secure on behalf of the BBC. So
what if they find out not enough young people are logging onto iPlayer, for example?
Well, I mean, really, I think doesn't this boil down to the nature of the content and probably the marketing of that content as well? You know, Radio 1 have their own channel now on the iPlayer. And interestingly, some of those programmes are doing very significant numbers, certainly more than you might find, you know, for a programme airing on BBC Two or BBC Four. Then you say, well, if the content's there and is being consumed, it's a case of how you market the brand to make sure that the right demographic is aware of where they can go to find that content, i.e. the iPlayer.
And the BBC store closed this month, didn't it? Why do you think that failed?
It was too late to the party.
Why? Because they were using the iTunes model of charging per download rather than the Netflix model of streaming.
If the BBC had looked at ITV, they'd have seen that it doesn't work. ITV tried micropayments for shows. It flopped enormously. I mean, it fell right on its face. And they stopped it very quickly at ITV. Around the same time, BBC launches BBC Store. And here we are, 2 years later, and it's closing as well.
So do we know, I mean, maybe you don't, what is the option now if you're an expat and you live in Cyprus and you want to watch EastEnders? Is there a way of paying legitimately to watch BBC content online, or does that not exist now?
The BBC's just launched BritBox with ITV and some other organisations.
I genuinely haven't heard about this. Steve's nodding along. BritBox, go on. So that's Hulu for British content, is it?
Basically, it's a shop window for the best of British context. But yeah, I think it's kind of aimed at expats, and you can get your fix of EastEnders or Coronation Street.
There's also plenty of BBC shows that obviously are available on Netflix and iTunes, and I can tell
and
you
Amazon.
That
that's where you go for BBC Worldwide and content Amazon. Now in the UK. Yeah, stuff you're already paying for.
I mean, the model of paying per episode was completely overrun by Netflix and Amazon. You know, people expect to pay a monthly fee, no nonsense, and watch whatever content they want.
Well, that was so good. Do you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to throw a fifth BBC story into the mix.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah. It's a complete BBC media pod.
And that is because Chris Moyles, Tony Blackburn and more, finish my sentence for me, Steve,
are getting together to appear on Radio 1 Vintage, is it called?
Or? That's right, yeah. Radio 1 Vintage. So it's a DAB pop-up like Radio 2 Country or Radio 2 50s, except it's for the old Radio 1 DJs. Why are they doing this?
They're doing it because it's the 50th anniversary of Radio 1.
Now, you say don't kick the BBC when they're down. You think of the history of Radio 1 presenters, and you might think that reuniting them all on a platform would be a bad idea PR-wise. You know, they got up to some mischief, didn't they? I can imagine it must have been a nightmare internally at the BBC how you commemorate 50 years of the BBC without mentioning Dave Lee Travis, Jimmy Savile and all the rest of it.
Well, and also don't forget how you commemorate 50 years for a youth brand. And that's probably the real angle, I think, to this story, that I actually think Ben Cooper's made the right call, which is to say, look, I'm not going to go overboard on air because...
On Radio 1.
On Radio 1, because to my young audience, it's kind of... Not only is it irrelevant, do I want to shout about the fact that I'm supposed to be this, you know, a youth brand and I'm 50 years old?
Yeah.
Not quite sure if that works.
Yeah.
So what I'll do is I'll celebrate the heritage of it and allow people for who this is meaningful, i.e. people like us who are old and grey...
You remember Chris Moyles.
And remember it.
How old are we?
Yeah, to get a bit more excited. I think it's quite a neat idea, and I think the sort of launch of it, the PR round was very deftly handled by Ben.
And to take the other side of that coin, I did see the Mail Online article that was furious that listeners in their 50s and 60s who would love to hear Tony Blackburn may not have digital radios at home, and therefore they're being deprived of hearing this on FM.
Can you pin that on the BBC, though?
Well, they've chosen to do it as a pop-up, haven't they, rather than broadcasting on Radio 2, for example.
But the real crux of what you're saying there is that digital radio is not as widely available as it should be.
Yes, I suppose. And actually, it's the BBC's job to try and get people to buy DAB radios as well, and then maybe that's part of the reason they've done this.
And let's also be honest,
it's Daily
Mail would get...
Job.
The Daily Mail loves getting furious about anything to do with the BBC, so it's kind of, you know...
Will you be listening?
Probably not. I might tune in for a bit of curiosity, but, you know, I've heard Tony Blackburn enough. I don't really want to hear Simon Bates again. I don't know if he's going to be on. You know, Moyles I can listen to any day of the week, but... So it probably isn't for me, though.
I think I'm with you, actually, which is a shame because I don't know why that is. I'd like the idea of listening to a well-crafted two-hour documentary about Radio 1. I just don't want to hear Tony Blackburn chatting to Nick Grimshaw. I can sort of imagine what that would be like without hearing it.
I mean, I'll tell you, I don't know whether they're doing this. If they were creating a little documentary to go on the iPlayer, actually,
yes,
I'd watch that. I'd be quite interested in sort of some of the stories and what was going on behind the scenes. But to hear the same broadcasters on air again... playing music from yesteryear and rehashing their old stories, I'm not sure that's so interesting.
You can quite easily imagine something like that on BBC Four as well.
Well, you need to imagine is the Radio 2 schedule, isn't it? I suppose that's the problem. That's where Radio 1 presenters go, isn't it? And they're more popular than ever.
The decent ones, yeah.
Yeah. Well, here's something you don't find on the BBC. We're going to take an ad break.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Time for some news in brief now. Jake and Steve are still with me. and let's do post-truth news. Not fake news. Let's talk about people saying other things are fake news. You with me? Last week, Jon Snow was the subject of accusations of bias on air after it was reported he'd joined protests at Glastonbury. And then on Thursday, Liam Fox hit out at the BBC, claiming the corporation would rather the country failed than Brexit succeed. Bias in broadcast journalism, which is supposed to be regulated, although Jon Snow wasn't actually broadcasting at the time he was at Glastonbury, of course. Your thoughts, Jake?
Well, shock horror, Channel 4 News is mildly left-leaning.
Yeah.
Although, to be fair to Jon Snow, he said he had no recollection of doing the crude Tory chant at...
Which is entirely consistent with the weekend at Glastonbury,
yeah, at Glastonbury. Although Jon Snow, I spoke to him before the election because he was very grumpy about the fact that Theresa May hadn't given him an interview.
Right.
As it turned out, she capitulated at the 11th hour and gave him a 10-minute slot. I think it was the day before the election. So his groaning and mumbling had paid off in the end. And, you know, again, shock horror, big Tory sticks the boot into the BBC.
Where do we stand, though, on Jon Snow? Because it is, like you say, his politics are fairly evident from watching Channel 4 News. I mean, OK, he does suggest questions from the other side of the political spectrum when he's interviewing someone, and he's a good interviewer. But it's fairly clear which side of the political debate he comes from and why you'd tune into Channel 4 News in the first place. And then he has had these rants online, not at Glastonbury, but, you know, about Gaza, for example, which a BBC reporter would not be allowed to do. Is that cool?
But isn't that the whole point? He's doing it because he's not a BBC reporter, because he is able to do it. He's not bound by the same restrictions.
But he is bound by the same restrictions.
Well, he's bound by the
same regulation.
He's bound by the same regulation when he's broadcasting. I you know, from a personal perspective, I would feel more, you know, I always quite like it when you don't really know the politics of the people fronting the news, and that you then are very surprised when they vote one way or another, when many years later they come out and tell you. Do I have an issue about him shouting things at Glastonbury? Not particularly. I think the more sinister thing is the story you mentioned with Liam Fox, because this is only a week or two after Andrew Leadsom's outburst about the news or the broadcast institutions need to be more patriotic, I think was her word. And, you know, this is really tied up in that fervour that we saw from very, very ideological leavers before the election, you know, get rid of the saboteurs and all that sort of nonsense, enemies of the people. And it feels to me like there's still a very small faction who, rather wanting to encourage a true element of dialogue and debate within the media and within broadcasting, are still trying to squash and shut down that debate and don't like it when they hear something from the other side. And actually, as a vibrant democracy, regardless of where you sit on the political fence of the referendum, it's really important that we can have that debate. And that does mean, whichever side you're on, sometimes you're going to hear things you don't agree with and you don't like.
How many Brexit voters do we think work for BBC News?
Do you know what? I don't think this is a game worth getting into. I mean, first of all, BBC News is run by a guy who used to head up the Times, which is a Murdoch paper.
No,
but
there is. I mean, I absolutely personally believe there isn't a bias on screen, and I'll defend the BBC's impartiality. But it is true that the people who make the programmes are mostly sort of left-leaning Oxbridge graduates, like they always were.
Well, potentially. But if you speak to Momentum supporters, they would rant as well about how anti-Corbyn the BBC has been.
Vociferously, yeah.
Well, that too, because they're Blairites, aren't they? Right. That's who they are. They're people like me.
Well,
I
think more to the point is you have people on the far right and people on the far left complaining, and therefore, you know,
they're doing their job.
They're probably getting it right.
Sport now, and Sky. We're going to talk about Sky now, not the BBC. Sky Sports are dropping numbered channels branding. So no more Sky Sports 1, 2, 3, etc. And instead, we're going to get Sky Sports Football 1 and Sky Sports Rugby or whatever. Good idea?
I'm not sure it'll make a huge amount of difference. Sky's just had its biggest drop in Premier League viewing figures in 7 years.
Why is that? Is that BT?
Probably a couple of reasons. Well, BT will be an element within that, but more people are watching through Sky's online services like Now TV and Sky Go, which don't get counted by Barb, incidentally. And the huge growth in illegal streaming is doing the damage. I'm a big football fan. When I want to watch Spurs play, I will buy a day pass and watch it through Now TV. Do I care that it's on Sky Sports Football or Sky Sports 1? I don't give a damn.
No, but at the moment, as I understand it, because I'm not into sport at all, you either buy a Sky Sports package or you don't. Whereas presumably this is paving the way so that, like Now TV, but through your satellite dish, you'd be able to say, I'm only interested in the football. So
potentially,
that would
help the price. And if it makes it cheaper for me to then buy a day pass just to watch the football channel, then great.
I think that's the idea, isn't it, Steve? Or specifically, actually, probably not football, but if you're only interested in Formula One, for example, then it would definitely be cheaper.
Well, it obviously makes it easier from a branding perspective or from a marketing perspective to sort of understand what each proposition is. But I suppose it goes back to the heart of what so much of the entertainment industry is struggling with, which is, you know, kind of, does it matter what your channel's called anymore? It's kind of what you're saying, Jake, that you've got to look at what the audience behaviour is, which is an on-demand pattern. And you're quite right. Illegal streaming, especially for sport, is massive now, absolutely massive. But why is it massive? Because it gives an on-demand option. I want to watch it, therefore I'll go and find where I can watch it from. It's exactly the same issue the music industry were having all those years ago. You know, the difficulty for Sky is they've paid so much money now for the football as well, that actually the Sky package is very, very expensive. And when you only have to pay whatever it is, £8 a month for Netflix, there's a vast difference between that and the basic package you need to pay for Sky. And then when you add on the sports channels, you are talking about hundreds of pounds expenditure more than you would be if you're just doing illegal streams and a bit of Netflix.
So if you follow that through to its logical conclusion, that means less money in football, doesn't it, in 10 years' time?
Potentially.
Actually, no, I don't think so, because the Premier League is now a global proposition. And so it's getting, I think, to the point where it has the potential to, even in terms of a domestic supply, potentially break out. So, you know, someone, I think they're probably in the place where someone is always going to now pay the money they want because they're such a global proposition now. And in fact, I think I'm right in saying the revenues that they're now getting in from international broadcast rights exceed the old domestic deal. That I caveat that. I might have that completely wrong, but it's certainly very, very significant. You know, you go anywhere in the world now in a way that you never saw before, and the Premier League is a global brand and the clubs within it are global brands.
Tell me about it. So irritating, isn't it, when you're in another country? Where are you from? England. Manchester United. I literally have no response for that. Sticking with Sky, and the Culture Secretary, Karen Bradley, has said that she is minded, that's the quote, to refer Rupert Murdoch's bid for Sky to the Competition Commission. Now, many people that we spoke to at the start of the year, Jake, thought that this was going to be a done deal for 21st Century Fox, that 2017 would mean full-on ownership by the Murdochs. Why hasn't it happened, Jake?
My opinion hasn't changed.
You think
the government's going through the motions at the moment.
Oh, really?
Okay. Yeah. It's a question of when, not if.
Yeah, but if it is a question of when, the answer to that could be 12 months.
It could be delayed, but I think as long as 21st Century Fox feel it's moving in the right direction and they're getting the right signals behind the scenes, I think they'll be quite relaxed about that. If you talk to people at Sky, they are so confident that this deal is going to happen, they almost dismiss you when you ask them about it.
Brexit's around the corner. Will this deal look better or worse if it does get delayed by a year?
Rupert Murdoch has waited, you know, 6 years. You know, the last time he had a go was 2011.
He ain't getting any younger, though.
Yeah, but his sons are running 21st Century Fox, and all the indications are is that they're going to continue and carry out his wishes.
Time to move into print now, and last week saw the Paul Foot Award winner announced. Now, that award, named after the celebrated Private Eye reporter, celebrates the best investigative journalism of the year. And it was won by Emma Yule for a campaign in which she highlighted the plights of thousands of people living in temporary accommodation in Hackney. Jake, this was won by a local newspaper, the Hackney Gazette. How significant is that?
Well, it's huge credit to the Hackney Gazette. And it's great for them that at a time when all you hear is negative stories about the bottom falling out of local press, that they're winning an award like this, and there is proper investment in investigative journalism at grassroots.
A sense that maybe that's why they won the award, though, because, you know, the other nominees were the usual suspects. Whether the Guardian was in there, actually the Daily Mail was in there, interestingly, but, you know, they were better resourced publications. I wonder if this won because it was the exception rather than the rule.
Well, anything that can encourage this to take place is clearly a positive thing. I mean, I'm waiting for the moment when we might see some of this sort of work starting to happen online in terms of online websites or online blogs. I mean, I know
that hyperlocal stuff.
Yeah. Well, both. I mean, you know, the idea of people really starting to sort of unveil local scandals doesn't need to be something that is just the preserve of a local newspaper, though I obviously know that takes time, effort and money. Plenty of other forms of media have found their way online and found new ways to be done. And this feels like something that's still quite old school, quite old fashioned. We still have that romantic image, don't we, of the sort of hack digging away at the story.
But I love that though.
Yeah, yeah.
And do you know what? We're sitting here talking about it. And that is huge credit to the Hackney Gazette. You know, it shows that if you invest in proper journalism, you'll get recognised for it. And that's something to be celebrated.
But I do wonder, and I don't know this woman, Emma, at all, so I'm not in any way suggesting that this was her motivation. But a lot of people who work for local press do it because it is still considered a step up into then working for the Nationals or working for another title. When you say, Steve, that you know this could be replaced perhaps in the future by basically a citizen journalist or someone doing it for online advertising, I mean, the truth is going to council meetings is boring, isn't it? Like going through local stories in depth is boring. People do it because they earn their stripes and then they can do something more exciting. I wonder if anyone's ever going to say, yeah, what I really want to do is go to every council meeting.
Well, there's always someone. It's not necessarily about council meetings, is it? But it's just about having the tenacity to sort of dig under what seems on the surface and the time that takes. But there's always someone who's up for that, you know.
I mean, it is a slightly romanticised idea now, isn't it? You think about Broadchurch and the local paper in that, or House of Cards and the role of the Washington Herald.
I think, you know, young people who recognise that doing proper journalism at a local newspaper is going to help them replicate that at a bigger title, they're right still. It's just that training in the journalism industry, or at least growth opportunities in the journalism industry, are changing rapidly. And what you're seeing nowadays is more and more young people joining online editions of, you know, the big newspaper websites, coming to places like Business Insider, and they're learning journalism in a very different way. It's much more about how they can generate a big audience for their work, rather than the sort of mechanics of getting good stories.
Did you start on the local press, Jake?
I didn't, no. I started on Trade Press,
right,
which I would argue is a similar route in.
Any of them have amusing titles?
I used to work for a magazine called Supply Management, but I would never be disparaging about my time there.
Fun. That sounds fun.
About the very sexy world of procurement. But it was, you know, I learned a lot there.
Yeah.
You know, how to build people's trust, how to break stories. You cannot get that experience in a classroom.
I remember one of our panellists worked for Big Farms Weekly or something, didn't they? But I can't remember which one it was. If you are interested to know more about this Private Eye Award, then you'll be pleased to know that producer Matt has made a special Private Eye podcast, it says here, about the awards. Just search for Page 94 in your podcast
plug.
App. Again, I see no regulator here, Jake.
Yeah.
We're on a roof terrace. We can do what we like. Finally, just before the quiz, did either of you see the editorial that the Daily Mail ran about The Guardian recently?
I did.
We're seeing nods.
Yes.
The Daily Mail called The Guardian the real purveyors of hatred. Who wants to tell this story? It's quite a fun gossipy story, isn't it?
The Guardian ran a cartoon after the recent terrorist attacks, which showed a truck or van, can't quite remember which it was, and I think it was, can't remember if it was ploughing into people, but anyway, it was clear
what into the mosque in Finsbury Park,
right?
And it said,
and on the side,
the
exactly
the
on the side of the bus, it said, "Read the Sun and the Mail." And the Guardian then wrote a piece saying, you know, basically, if you make hateful noises, eventually these things might well happen. And the Mail responded very angrily. But what they said was, how dare the Guardian accuse our 4 million readers of being purveyors of hate? And
which isn't what they were
no,
doing.
No, there's a nuance here.
They were saying
here
that the one reader that killed people, yeah, might have read the Mail and the Sun.
Well, there's a nuance here, which is what the Guardian was doing was attacking the editorial stance that is taken by those papers when it comes to stories around minorities and Islam and other very sensitive issues. And what the Mail read that as was not just an attack on their brand, but an attack on their entire ecosystem, which I don't think is... it certainly wasn't my reading. Just as a punter, that wasn't what I read into the cartoon. I think if you have a layer of sophistication and awareness, you understand the point that was being made.
But actually, it wasn't a very sophisticated cartoon, was it? I mean, you're saying a layer of sophistication. The truth is, you know, someone who's an extremist will be inspired by what they read, but also by what they see and what they hear. You know, there are many media outlets that trade in inflammatory material.
I mean, isn't it a golden political rule that you never respond to the satirical cartoon? It's just not the done thing.
It's a golden PR rule, isn't it?
Yeah.
Don't make yourself the centre of the story.
I think one of the brilliant angles of this story is, you know, the idea of Paul Dacre sort of foaming at the mouth, banging out this leader. and the fact that it claims that he has nothing to do with the Mail Online.
So the leader said that the Guardian were the real purveyors of hate.
Yes.
Because they're run by extreme leftists and they fail to understand the distinction. This apparently makes you a purveyor of hate. They fail to understand the distinction that Katie Hopkins writes for Mail Online, not the Daily Mail. I think it's fair to say that's a distinction that many readers fail to understand as well, isn't it, when they encounter the article online?
Well, they make no effort to offer that distinction. And it was brilliantly lanced in Private Eye last week and by James O'Brien on LBC, when he was saying that Paul Dacre trousered a £263,000 bonus for increasing the audience on Mail Online and investing in the Mail Online.
It doesn't help the fractious political situation at the moment, does it, that the mainstream press is itself becoming so fractured?
I think the other interesting thing around this story, actually, when you dig into it a bit, is the fact that the Mail has brought this to the attention of their readers, when I'd lay pretty good money that most Daily Mail readers were not aware of this cartoon.
Not big consumers of Guardian cartoons.
Or what The Guardian had written at all. Because obviously, why would they be? The Guardian sells whatever it sells, I don't know, 250,000, 300,000 copies. The Mail sells whatever it sells, significantly more. There's only going to be a small overlap of people who might buy both publications.
And they all work in the media.
Yeah. and so to then put this at the forefront of your paper and really bring it to the attention of all your readers seems interesting in one sense, but maybe in the other goes back to what we're saying about Liam Fox. It's kind of this polarizing thing that we've got going on within our society, which we've seen for many years in America, and which makes me feel very uncomfortable in the sense of, is that really where we want our discussion and debate to go to, whichever side of the political fence you sit on?
And actually, the internet's exacerbated that, hasn't it? Because there are blogs and podcasts and all the rest of it, and news sites that are online only, that clearly offer content to a niche that's interested in a particular political viewpoint. The press, they might as well sort of dig their heels in even more. You know, you always knew the Daily Mail was right-wing, but they had to try and appeal to the odd Daily Mirror reader who might buy them as well. Now it's just like, no, that's not what we do. What we do is this.
It does feel like the lines of division are ever clearer these days between the extreme right-wing press and the Corbynites online.
We should probably say right-wing press rather than the extreme right-wing press. I'm not sure.
Well, but Breitbart you might categorise as extreme right-wing.
Yes. Possibly. Yeah.
Breitbart, I think you would.
I mean, obviously I'm not. I'm trying to make a distinction between...
Careful, you don't want Dacre after you.
Yes.
You're the real player.
He's looking nervous already.
Now, there is just time for our media quiz. This week, it's entitled News Bites. I'm going to make three badly constructed food pun news headlines, and your job is to decipher the media story within. It's best of three. Buzz in with your name. So, Steve, you will say...
Steve.
And Jake, you will say...
Jake.
The winner is Tfal. The loser is product placement. Here is food pun number one. He was a film critic who knew his onions.
Steve. Oh.
Oh, Jake just got that.
It's Barry Norman.
And why not? Yes, the death of Barry Norman, face of the BBC film programme for about 100 years, and, of course, Pickled Onions, who died this week at the age of 83. Did either of you meet Mr. Norman?
I did not.
No, but I know he's not Barry Cryer.
Correct.
Yes. But, so the Mail Online, when they broke this story online...
Oh, did they?
They had a picture of Barry Cryer, not Barry Norman.
I did meet Barry Norman, thanks for asking. He was one of my first ever student magazine journalist interview pieces. I asked him for a half hour to publicise his memoir, and he gave me 2 hours, and he bought me lunch.
Wow.
In a pub in Stevenage.
That is a gentleman.
Very nice man. Here's question number two. Which commentator has had his cake, eaten it, and then dropped the mic?
Jake. Henry Blofeld?
Correct. Henry Blofeld will retire from Test Match Special in the autumn. Now, Barry Norman I could talk about all day. Henry Blofeld, obviously, I've literally never heard. Tell me why he's so special.
A phenomenal broadcaster, wonderful, rich, resonant voice. If you've ever listened to Test Match Special, he has been one of the voices of that programme, which I think I'm right in saying is 60 years old maybe this year. I think I might be wrong on that front, but an amazing broadcaster.
Time for a Test Match Special pop-up.
Could be, yeah. Test Match Special vintage on the way.
Here's question number three. Why has Blue Peter had its chips? You can guess the story. Does anyone go on, Jake? Yes.
Did the Mail write something about Blue Peter ratings being zero or something?
Correct.
But I think I saw a rebuttal online.
Okay. The story as I have it, Jake Cantor, is that the show, Blue Peter, rated zero, according to Barb, on an episode that was broadcast in June. But you think there's some controversy over this?
But I think the Mail Online has obviously taken that figure and produced a colourful report about it, which has then made its way onto Twitter, and the BBC press office, I think, responded on Thursday to it directly, saying, "We beg to differ," and published some...
It's actually 0.00.
It's a little better than that, to be fair to Blue Peter.
Is it the end for Blue Peter, though? I mean, that does seem like a brand that exists purely for legacy nostalgia, not because any self-respecting eight-year-old rushes home to see it.
I hope not. It's very difficult these days, I think, to really know... I mean, we kind of started the pod talking about children's content, and it is so disparate now. It's very difficult, I think, to really, with any confidence, predict what sort of content kids are going to consume.
But magazine shows
forward.
Generally are
one's natural inclination would be to feel it's a bit outdated and old-fashioned, and yet at the same time, as I said, CBBC is definitely a safe place for children to go, and the content they produce is still phenomenal, and so it kind of runs counterintuitive a bit. One would hope that the game is not up yet.
Why would you ditch it? You're at a period in broadcasting now where big legacy brands are being revived, and you've got a big legacy brand that's never been taken off air. It's still going strong. The BBC should continue to back it.
Okay, well, just to bring things full circle then, back to our original discussion and the Radio 1 vintage and children, will we ever see Top of the Pops come back? Because that is something I would actually like to see. Is it too tainted now?
I don't think so. But you might see version of Live and Kicking coming back.
That's not the same. But I'll take what I can get. And you have won the quiz. Even though that was a
resoundingly
ridiculous thing to say.
Much to my upset.
Jake Cantor is the winner. Steve Ackerman, thank you very much. That is it for our show today. Catch up with previous episodes and get new ones as soon as they're released by subscribing for free at our website, themediapodcast.com. This episode is dedicated to BBC journalist Lue Ismail. Thank you, Lue. Join him, keep us on the air, and get an entire episode of this show dedicated to you. All you need to do is go to themediapodcast.com/donate. Oh yes, and give generously. As much money as you possibly can. I've been Ollie Mann, the producer, Matt Hill. The Media Podcast is a PPM production. And until next time, bye-bye.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.